Old Soldiers, Brendan DuBois. When performing a boring chore like splitting wood, you tend to dwell on trivia to pass the time, such as the two distinct sounds you encounter during the job. The first is a thump, when the maul you're using makes a slight indentation into the wood. The other is a sharp crack when you've started a major split that means you're almost finished with that chunk of soon-to-be firewood. Thoughts like these were going through my mind as I was about an hour into my morning woodcutting routine one spring Saturday. Then a dark blue Ford LTD with government plates bumped its way up my dirt driveway and I wasn't bored anymore. And when Special Agent Cameron of the FBI and a companion got out of the car, I momentarily wondered what kind of sound a maul would make while being buried in the base of someone's skull. Cameron carried a slim leather briefcase and his white hair was combed carefully over the back of his head, as if he had just had his picture taken for his official government ID. He had on a charcoal gray suit, unlike his companion, about 20 years younger, who wore blue jeans, white polo shirt, and a dark brown leather jacket.
"Owen," Cameron said as I rested near the woodpile, "I'd like to present Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith works for another government agency."
I stuck out my hand, and as Smith came forward to shake it, I wiped it off with my handkerchief, and Smith paused, the slight grin on his face steady under my insult. His dark brown hair was cut short, and his blue eyes were bright, brittle, and sharp. Underneath his polo shirt, there seemed to be hard muscle. He looked like a guy who would spend his vacation in Europe, retracing Wehrmacht invasion routes through Poland with a smile on his face.
"Really?" I said. "And would that government agency be the GAO? Is your work being audited, Agent Cameron?"
Cameron didn't look pleased.
"No, and this meeting has nothing to do with my previous visits. Mr. Smith has a matter to discuss with you in private. When the two of you are finished, I'll take him back to Portland. That's it."
When the government pays your bills and keeps you alive, year after year, after any competent actuary would have written you off as dead long since, then I guess listening is the polite thing to do. So I shrugged and said, "All right, why don't the both of you come in?" Smith spoke for the first time.
"That sounds grand."
He came forward, but Cameron shook his head.
"No," he said, "I want no part of this."
So Smith followed me into the farmhouse as Cameron trudged back to the LTD. In the kitchen, I poured myself a tall glass of lemonade, offering nothing to my uninvited guest, and we sat at the round oak table. Perhaps I was being childish, but Smith didn't seem to notice. He leaned back in his chair and rested his large hands on his flat stomach.
"Agent Cameron gave me a thorough briefing on the way over here," he said. "You certainly have a fascinating past, Mr. Taylor."
"Ain't I lucky?" I said.
"And it's that past that has brought me here," he said. "Your talents. We want to use them, just for a short time."
"Sorry, I'm retired." His smile was wide and merry.
"Sorry in return. You've been unretired and turned over to us, and if you don't care to cooperate, we can make your life quite miserable very quickly. I know what you've got here. In return for certain past services, you live here in total freedom, save for a few minor restrictions, like staying within the town limits, which brings me to my next point. Ever hear of Marion?"
Something seemed to wiggle around in my throat.
"Maximum security prison."
He waved a hand in the air.
"No, not maximum. Maximum is a dime a dozen. I'm sure even this rural wonderland has a maximum prison. No, Marion is the ultimate federal penitentiary. An inmate lives alone in a concrete cube 8 feet in each direction. Once a week, you get out for an hour for some sunshine and fresh air. That's it. No radio, no television, newspapers and books strictly controlled, and the food is government supplied. So, we reach an understanding here. Everything's fine. If not, tomorrow at this time you'll be staring at concrete."
I tried to stay calm. "Special Agent Cameron."
"Look," he interrupted. "Some time ago, Cameron made a mistake. A big one. In a little Texas town called Waco. Ever wonder why he's way out here in this area? Waco is why. And Waco is why Cameron cooperates, which includes lending one of his charges for a while. So, Owen, what's it going to be?
I put my hands under the table because they were clenching into fists so hard that I could feel fingernails starting to break skin. He waggled a finger in my direction.
No, no, no. I want to hear the words from your mouth that you're on board. Then I will tell you what we have planned.
I nodded and then said, All right, I'm on board. Smith's grin got wider.
Thanks. And I also won $20. Cameron bet me you'd say no. Okay, here's the drill.
He reached into his jacket and pulled out a small slip of paper and tossed it over.
There's a man named Len Malowski, lives up in Cardiff, about an hour north of here. He's in his mid-60s, owns a small farm. That's his address.
I glanced at the paper. And what's so special about Len Malowski?
What's special is that his real name is Leonid Malenkov. He's a Soviet military intelligence operative, placed here in deep cover almost 4 decades ago. You know those Jap soldiers who lived on in Guam and the Philippines years after the war was over who didn't give up? Same story, except they're here and they're Russian.
So? I guess that wasn't the response Smith was looking for, and his smile faded.
Some old records we've kept over the years, we've managed to finally decode them. You'd be surprised what's for sale now over in Moscow. We found Len's name and a bunch of other names, all Soviet military intelligence, all placed into this country at about the same time during the late 50s.
And what was he going to do while in Maine? Burn down a forest?
Who knows and who cares, Smith said. That he's still here is what counts. And that's why I'm here with you.
At the risk of repeating myself, I'll do just that. I said, So what? Hasn't the news gotten to you folks yet? The Cold War's over. They lost. We won. We have a hell of a budget deficit to pay, but they have McDonald's in Red Square. Their nuclear subs are rusting and sinking at dockside, and their soldiers spend their time harvesting potatoes and trying to stay alive. What's the point of going after this guy? His eyes flashed at me.
The point is, we know we won the Cold War, but some people in Moscow haven't gotten the message. They don't like having NATO move in next door. They don't like having American fast food next to Lenin's tomb. They don't like American game shows on their TV. And we want to send them a message.
I picked up the paper again. And how does Len become a part of this message? Smith's gaze was steady, unblinking.
We want you to go up to his farm, pay him a visit, confirm his background, and then handle it.
I was suddenly aware of how tired I was from chopping all that wood and from talking to this awful young man. Handle it how?
Don't play wedding night virgin with me, Owen. I've read your record, know your background. You know exactly what I mean by handle it.
I slowly nodded. So I do. Mokridela, right? Russian for wet work. After all, blood is wet and tends to get on your shoes and clothing. A nice piece of euphemism from Department 5 of the old KGB. And by handling an old man who's probably clipping newspaper coupons and wondering how to pay for fertilizer this spring, this is going to do just what for you and your friends?
A message, Smith said slowly. A demonstration. By retiring this old network of theirs, we make an effective demonstration to the right people with a minimum of fuss. More efficient and cheaper than flying over the Secretary of State to talk about trade issues or some other goddamn nonsense.
I crumpled up the paper. And part of the minimal fuss is me, right? Deniability in case anything goes wrong. If I'm caught, I'm a career criminal with mysterious ties who one day killed a Maine farmer for no good reason. Right?
Who says retirees are losing their marbles?
Smith said. I looked out the window at the parked LTD and the man inside. Part of my agreement with the Department of Justice is that I know,
he said. You're not allowed to leave the confines of this lovely little town without express prior permission, blah, blah, blah. All taken care of. You have a week, Owen. 7 days from now, we'll be back for results. Or your bag better be packed. And that bag should contain a toothbrush and nothing else. The clock is running. Understood?
Understood. Smith clapped his hands together and stood up.
Great. Glad we could reach an agreement.
He walked out of the kitchen, and as he strolled to the LTD, I had a fantasy of running downstairs to retrieve one of my slightly illegal weapons and blowing away Mr. Smith before his hand reached the car door. I replayed it in my head as the car left my property. There are negatives associated with life in a small town. The local cable provider thinks one channel from Boston is stretching its cultural limits. No bookstores, and the nearest supermarket has boiled ham and American cheese as the extent of its deli offerings. But there are some advantages, too, and one of them owns and works at the Pinette General Store. Miriam Woods is my oldest and dearest friend in town, and she winked at me as I finished a late lunch of tomato soup and a BLT. She's a widow, several years younger than I am, with dark brown hair and even darker eyes that are lightly framed by wrinkles. She owns the store. She runs the town post office out of a storefront window off to the side, and she's also one of the town's three elected selectmen. As she picked up plates, her son Eric was restocking shelves in one of the far aisles. She looked over at him and then at me and lowered her voice.
"This Tuesday," she said, "Eric has basketball practice, and I was thinking of coming over to your place for dinner."
"Really?"
"Really. You supply the dinner, and I'll supply the desserts. One of them will be in an ice cream container."
She lowered her voice even more and winked again as she started wiping the counter. I said slowly, "But I won't be home."
"Well, there's always Thursday night, because..."
"Miriam, I won't be home all next week." She stopped, wiping the counter.
"Oh."
And my dear Miriam was able to stuff about a ton of frost, disappointment, and inquiry into that little two-letter word. "That's right. I have business to attend to." Her wiping cloth was clenched in a fist.
"I see. What kind of business?"
"I'm sorry, I really can't say. It'll take less than a week, and then I'll be back." She managed to smile and shook her head and went over to the cash register, counting and recounting bills, all while talking as if talking to herself.
"You never once agreed to go away with me for a trip to somewhere, even if it's just Portland or Bar Harbor. You've always said you couldn't leave the town, that you wouldn't feel comfortable."
Then she looked at me and slammed the cash drawer shut.
"Now you tell me you're leaving town for a week and you can't tell me why. To hell with that, and to hell with you."
She marched to the rear of the store and I followed, but she locked herself into her little post office cubicle. I suppose it would have taken me all of 30 seconds to get through the lock, but I knew I would pay for those 30 seconds for a very long time. Instead, I went outside to my truck and was climbing in when I heard a familiar voice.
"Owen, got a sec?"
I rolled down the truck's window as Eric approached in his white store apron. He's about as tall as I am, but gangly, with the loose limbs of a 15-year-old. He shares his mother's hair and eyes, and those eyes were troubled now. "Sure," I said. "More than a sec. Whatever you need."
"Just wanted to see how you're doing with the internet. Got any more questions for me?"
I did at that, and we talked techno-speak for a while, him using phrases like HTML and links and hypertext with practiced ease, while I struggled along like a backwoodsman who's entered 6th grade at the age of 40. Eric had helped introduce me to the joys of cyberspace and was my own personal tech helpline. I asked him a few questions, and he gave me more than a few answers. Then he nodded back toward the store.
"I heard most of what went on back there, though I wish I hadn't."
"I wish I hadn't taken part in it, so don't worry." Quick nod as he smoothed down the front of his store apron.
"Mom gets like this around this time every year. This is when Dad died, and it bothers her still, though she never says a word."
"Does it bother you?" I asked. He shrugged.
"Not like it bothers her. I don't remember him that well. He spent most of his time either out in the woods or in a bar. Best memory I have is him lying on the couch, trying to balance a Coors can on his forehead and yelling at Mom when she didn't move fast enough to get him another one. That's about it.
I started up the truck, and he said,
"Don't worry, she'll be fine in a bit."
Honest? A wide smile.
Gosh, I don't know, Owen. I just thought that would make you feel better.
Thanks, I said. It did, just for a moment. I then drove home where I packed up and left the next morning to murder an old Soviet spy. The day was warm and I drove with the windows open, enjoying the wet smell of spring, of hidden whispers of trees and grass and crops ready to grow, ready to get back to life. As I drove out of town, I felt a tingle along my hands as an old and deep part of me appreciated that I was leaving the reservation. Mr. Mysterious Smith had been correct. There were certain things I could not do as part of my agreement with the Department of Justice, and one of them was to cross the boundaries of the township of Pinette. Even thinking of the bad business ahead of me, I couldn't help grinning as I watched the miles roll up on the odometer. For at least this day, I was free to go where I wanted. It was a heady feeling, and if I had found the right tune, I would have been singing. But the only thing on the radio was a syndicated pop psychologist who seemed to gauge her success by seeing how many of her callers burst into tears. About halfway to Cardiff, I pulled over at a mini mall and bought a strawberry ice cream cone. I strolled inside, checking out the stores and the people moving about, young and old, families and single men and women of all ages and sizes. I sat on a bench and finished my cone, thinking about the pundits who carped about the mauling of America. A serious problem, I'm sure, but on this spring day I was happy to be here, free to go into any one of half a dozen stores. Which I did. I bought a dozen new hardcover books and put them in the truck, went into a computer store and picked up some software, and then went over to an electronics store where I acquired a digital camera and a nice cassette tape recorder. Elsewhere, I spent an obscene amount of money on clothes, and when I left the mini mall, my credit card was almost smoldering at the unfamiliarity of so much use. I continued north and came to a tiny county airport. A sign outside said Fearless Fern's Flying Service, and I had a neat little thought of renting Fern and his flying service and heading out to British Columbia. Instead, I kept on the job. While the day had been warm, the night was cold indeed, and lying on the dirt and leaves in a copse of birch trees outside a Cardiff farmhouse was making my bones ache to the point where I wondered if they'd ache forever, or if a long, hot bath would set things straight. I was wearing a ghillie suit, a camouflage outfit with such varied colors and stripes of netting and cloth that even in daytime I would melt against the backdrop of forest. With a good ghillie suit and the patience to keep still, a hunter can be damn near invisible, even with the target standing next to him. My target wasn't standing next to me, though. He was walking around his old farmhouse about 100 feet from my hiding spot, alone except for an old collie dog that cowered whenever Len Molosky or Leonid Malenkov approached. The man appeared to be in his mid-60s, with thick white hair combed to one side and black-rimmed glasses. His face was red and fleshy, and he wore a checked flannel shirt and brand-new blue jeans. I had been watching him since dusk, watching him cook and eat dinner by himself, toss a bag of trash on the porch, kick the dog when it got in his way, and then sit on a couch to pass a few hours in the ghastly blue light of the television. There were some things I did not see. I didn't see him cleaning a Kalashnikov AK-47 by lamplight. I didn't see a flag of the old Soviet Union flapping in the breeze from a flagpole. And I didn't see an order of Lenin pinned to his thick chest. I lifted my binoculars so I could scan the property. The farmhouse was larger than mine, with two stories and a wraparound porch that went around three sides of the house. There was a barn off to the right, also larger than mine, but I didn't have any barn envy. And then what looked like a few dozen acres of fields beyond to the east. The nearest neighbor's house was about a half mile away. Everything on the property was neat but shabby, like he was doing all right but didn't want to show up the local populace. I put the binoculars down, exchanged them for a handheld night scope. The scenery flashed into a pale green as I scanned. Two pickup trucks, one on cement blocks, and a tractor and other equipment in the barn. Nothing out of the ordinary. Nothing, of course, except for me in the backyard, lying on the cold ground, 9mm Smith & Wesson Model 915 holstered to my side, water bottle, binoculars, night scope, and some hard candies all within easy reach. If I had been younger and more eager, I suppose I could have handled this job immediately and been back home by morning. But, among other things, I wasn't that person anymore. So I waited. The night air was still, and it was so quiet that I could hear the drone of engines far off in the distance, and the murmur of Len's television set. Eventually, Len got up from the couch and went upstairs. An upstairs light went on, and I heard the flush of a toilet, and then all the lights went off, and I stayed in the cold woods for another hour. Something rustled behind me, but I ignored it. I listened to the frantic hoo-hoo-hoo of an owl, and heard a crash of wings and a squeaking noise as something was killed just a few yards from me. And then I crept away, moving slowly. Getting out is as important as getting in. For the next couple of nights and days, I kept watch on Len's house and discovered he had a pattern. He worked in the barn in the mornings or went out into the fields with a tractor turning up the earth. At noon, he finished and went into town for lunch at the Cardiff Cafe. In the late afternoon, he spent his time around the house, and by the time evening rolled around, it was the same routine. Make dinner, kick the dog, watch television, and go upstairs. I envied his bed and his home. I was living out of the back of my truck, for I wanted no record of my stay at any hotel or motel in the area. After my nights of surveillance outside his house, I slowly and carefully trekked my way back through the woods to my truck and drove to a place I'd picked out earlier. In these woods were many dirt paths and logging roads, and from one of these, a different one each night, I backed into the woods until I was sure I couldn't be spotted. Then I slept poorly in the rear of the truck on a foam mattress wrapped in a sleeping bag, and while Len had a cozy hot breakfast, I made do with coffee from a little camp stove and cold cereal. Fires mean smoke, and smoke in the woods gets noticed, which is not what I planned for this little adventure. His midday journeys into town, which I timed, each lasted more than an hour. On day three, I waited till after he drove off, and then I rose from my hiding spot. I shed the ghillie suit for what would pass for a disguise in these woods. A pullover jacket, the better to hide my holstered 9mm, a long-billed cap, binoculars around my neck, and a Roger Torrey Peterson bird book in my hand. I sauntered into Len's backyard as if I belonged there, went up to the rear door, and in a few seconds I was inside. Len hadn't even bothered to lock the door. Inside and off to the left was a large kitchen. The collie looked up from the kitchen floor, eyes curious, and thumped his tail as I murmured softly and rubbed his head. The tail thumped a few more times, and he licked my hand and rolled over as I scratched his belly. Poor guy. Based on his treatment, I'm sure the collie would have helped me shift the furnishings into a moving van. But I had other plans. I moved quickly, starting in the basement. I took just a few minutes to peg Len as a neat freak, his basement tidier than my kitchen. Boxes of clothing and canned food were stacked on the shelves, and there was an oil furnace that looked as if it had powered the 1939 World's Fair. Upstairs, the collie wagged his tail again as I went through the kitchen, the living room, and the downstairs bathroom. Len had a few books, recent bestsellers, in the living room, and the usual news and sports magazines and newspapers. No Khrushchev Remembers, no Gulag Archipelago, no History of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. On the second floor I found his bedroom and a spare room, and besides neatly made beds, bureaus and closets filled with clothes and a few more magazines, nothing else. I checked the time.
I had been in the house about half an hour. Time to leave. Downstairs, I gave the collie another belly scratch and went back to the woods to put on the ghillie suit. 45 minutes later, Len came home. As I waited for him, I thought about what I had not seen in the house. Quite a lot. There were no family pictures on the walls or the bureaus. No collections of letters or scrapbooks of photos. No framed certificates of achievement from 4-H or the Grange or the Future Farmers of America. In short, the things that should have been there if Len were a usual Maine farmer. From inside the house came the yelp of the collie, and I refocused my binoculars. The next day I picked up a few groceries and made a quick phone call from a payphone at a combination gas station and convenience store, a new one. I had not shopped at the same store twice, because I didn't want to be remembered, not even for a moment. When Miriam picked up the phone, she said,
"Owen, I apologize."
"Oh," I said. "Very well, apology accepted." A sigh from the other end.
"Don't you even want to know what I'm apologizing for?"
I turned and looked at a large Agrimark dairy truck rumbling by. "You're right, I should have asked." Another sigh, but lighter than the first one.
"Look, I was having a bad time the other day. Some old memories."
"I hear you."
"Of course you hear me, but I don't think you understand. When you said you were leaving and you couldn't tell me much, well, I don't like being left high and dry twice in the same decade."
"I understand." I could hear voices in the background.
"Maybe you do, Owen. All right?"
"Absolutely, Miriam." And I was going to say something else when I heard a few more voices and then hers saying,
"Gotta go. Bye."
All in one breath as she hung up. When Len went back into town, I wandered around the reaches of his property in my birdwatcher's disguise. He had enough acreage for one man to farm if he hired help in the spring and fall. Beyond the edge of one of the fields, I found a dump where he had trashed a few appliances, a box spring, and some worn truck tires. When I walked up to investigate, a chipmunk jumped on a rusting washing machine and chattered at me. "Oh, hush up," I said. "Don't you see I'm trying to uncover a dangerous Soviet spy?" And I laughed. Heading back, I saw something behind the barn that I hadn't noticed before, a worn path leading into the woods. I followed it, looking for a stream or a fishing hole, but instead it went deeper into the pine forest and then up a slight incline. The trail was old and well-maintained, with branches and brush cleared away from the tree trunks. Last year's leaves crackled under my feet as I made my way. I stopped for a moment to note a red driveway reflector light nailed into a tree trunk. The nails were rust red from being outside a long time. Farther up the trail were more reflectors. The trail was marked for someone traveling through here at night. The climb got steeper and I rested for a few minutes, taking a swig of water from my bottle before following the path through a series of switchbacks. After a few minutes of climbing that made my thighs twitch, I was on top of the hill, breathing hard. "Excelsior," I muttered, as I sat down on the fallen tree log. The view was not what I expected. An airport was down there, with a long concrete runway that ran at an angle to the hill. A control tower and a number of hangars were in the distance, together with enough buildings for a small town. It was a much bigger airport than the one I had passed on the drive out, and also much bigger than such a remote and rural area would seem to need. From the knapsack, I pulled out my binoculars and a map of the county. I scanned the few small private planes parked near the hangars. Those hangars were scaled for aircraft much bigger and faster than these Cessnas and Piper Cubs. On the map, the marker for the town of Cardiff had a stylized aircraft symbol nearby. Below the cartoon plane were the words, "Raymond Air Force Base Strategic Air Command," closed and now available for civilian use. Looking down at the old Air Force base as I sat there, the damn spring sun didn't warm me a bit. That night in my ghillie suit, I watched Len go through his routine. Tonight was a bit different. At the kitchen table, he tossed down shot glass after shot glass of something from a clear bottle. Vodka was my guess. Then he started singing, a morose tune that I couldn't make out. It could have been in a foreign language, but it could have been that the breeze was blowing away from me, softening the sounds from the house. I waited for long hours as he gently placed his head on the kitchen table and fell asleep, and my hands and feet were trembling from cold before he woke to stagger upstairs. The night after the drinking bout, after Len left for town, I stepped right up in my birdwatcher's outfit. I whistled as I walked through his yard and through the open sliding barn door. Ain't rural life grand, where people keep their outbuildings wide open for the benefit of would-be assassins? A John Deere tractor was parked in the center of the barn, along with a collection of tills, spreaders, and harvesters. Everything looked to be in good working condition. There were a few bags of fertilizer and seed, and a ladder going up to the loft. I climbed it, wincing as a splinter dug into my hand, and on the second level found a collection of tools, leather harnesses, rolled blankets, and more bags of fertilizer. I went back down and outside past the tractor. Something was wrong. Something was quite wrong. I looked around, picking at the splinter in my hand. My internal alarm bells were jangling, and everything felt odd, as though my inner ear balance had gone haywire. I squinted at the barn. It was bigger outside than it was inside. I went back inside and paced the interior, counting off my steps, and then I came outside and repeated the process. The dimensions were wrong. Something was hidden inside.